like a cannonball of fire, just no stopping. Run them galloping beat up in them shields. Regular with them is like a brave.
CKUT
Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada. CKUT.
This message is intended for all Quebecers. We must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM, broadcasting not live, but still from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Ibbotson.
Today we broadcast from the Geojiage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe nations.
Today, we will be exploring the intersection between racism and ableism. We will focus on autism and police brutality and how our institutions inform us incorrectly about disability. These institutions include spaces of learning, law enforcement, and the broader concept of language. Before we begin our segment today, we want to issue a content warning as this segment discusses police brutality, murder, anti-Black racism, white supremacy, and ableism. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after a short music break.
Everything to you. You say you want to start something new, and it's breaking my heart you're leaving. Maybe I'm grieving, but if you want to leave, take good care. Hope you have a lot of nice things to wear, but then a lot of nice things turn bad out there. To get by just upon a smile. Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. I'll always remember you like a child, girl. You know I've seen a lot of what the world can do, and it's breaking my heart in two, because I never want to see you sad, girl. Don't be a bad girl, but if you wanna leave, take good care. Hope you make a lot of nice friends out there, but just remember there's a lot of bad, and beware. Beware. Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world. It's hard to get by just upon a smile.
remember you like a child, girl. Just remember there's a lot of bad and beware. Well, oh baby, baby, it's a wild world. It's hard to get by just upon a smile. Oh baby, baby, it's a wild world. I always remember you like a child, girl. Oh baby, baby, it's a wild world, and it's hard to get by just upon a smile. Oh baby, baby, it's a wild world, and I'll always remember you like a child, girl.
Broken heart and soul. And what do you do with the leftover you? And how do you know when to let go? Where does the good go? Where does the good go? Look me in the eye and tell me you don't find me attractive. Look me in the heart and tell me you won't go. Look me in the eye and promise no love's like I.
That was Cat Stevens with Wild World, followed by Tegan and Sarah with Where Does the Good Go? Now for our weekly headline roundup.
Families of inmates in Saskatchewan jails are gathering outside the Regina Correctional Center to raise awareness regarding their concerns for inmates with COVID-19. Julie Paul from Outship House First Nation spoke with APTN News about her concern for her son, River Peters, and the lack of proper medical care he is receiving post his positive COVID diagnosis. According to Paul, quote, "That's why I started the protest, because I found out he was sick. I didn't hear from him for 7 days. I am waiting on my son to call to see if they got their canteen, which is to help them get through their COVID time. All of them need extra supplements, even if they don't have COVID, so their immune system is built up," unquote. Paul fears her son does not have access to enough food to remain healthy as he fights the virus. When the two last spoke, her son reported that he was left with just a blanket and a book for over 23 hours. Additionally, he is only provided 2 meals a day. The Saskatchewan Department of Corrections declined the request to speak with APTN News. They did, however, release a statement saying, quote, "Corrections has taken numerous measures in consultation with public health officials to protect both staff and offenders. This includes quarantining new admissions for 14 days and providing a specific COVID-19 medical screening, isolation, and quarantine protocols for those who exhibit symptoms," unquote. Julie Paul tells APTN News there will be more protests to come, saying that, quote, "The emotional part of it is where they can't even contact their family members. That's just where I draw the line. Because if you can't hear your own mother or someone who loves you and you're restricted from calling them, then that's just inhumane," unquote. However, the province stated that inmates received 2 extra free minutes along with other privileged phone calls. Yet Julie Paul has only spoken with her son once since he tested positive for COVID-19.
Unless you've been living under a rock this past week, you'll have heard of the illegal attempted coup conducted by President Trump's MAGA fan base this past Wednesday. The storming of the Capitol building on January 6th was the culmination of a series of actions and events, which were instigated by Trump so that he could retain the presidency, that together amounted to an attempt at a self-coup. This attack was planned for the 6th, as lawmakers who were certifying Joe Biden's election victory resided in the White House that day. The attack left 5 dead, dozens arrested, and 25 domestic terrorism investigations have been opened since. Trump's Twitter and Facebook accounts have also since been suspended at risk of him inciting more violence. Also, House Republicans have blocked a Democratic request to bring up a resolution urging Vice President Mike Pence to start the U.S. Constitution's 25th Amendment process of removing Trump from office. For those who don't know, the 25th Amendment suggests that the standing president is no longer in proper health nor fit to serve the country and must be removed. The U.S. House Democrats on Monday introduced a resolution containing a single article of impeachment against President Donald Trump, charging him with, quote, "incitement of insurrection," unquote, for his role in the attack on the U.S. Capitol last week. Next, the House would proceed to impeachment. However, the full House is set to hold a roll call vote on that resolution on Tuesday, today, and it is expected to pass. After that, Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Pence will have 24 hours to respond. The Quebec provincial government implemented a curfew beginning last Saturday, meaning that residents cannot be out and about between the hours of 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. for at least a month. This is basically a last-ditch attempt to stop the spread of COVID, as hospital ICUs in Quebec are becoming overwhelmed. However, it has come to the attention of many that this implemented curfew is also in place for the homeless population of Quebec. The unhoused population of Montreal specifically has doubled since the onset of the pandemic. Shelters have had to close due to outbreaks of COVID-19, and those that remain open must serve fewer people in order to keep social distance policies while lacking the financing to meet demand. Meanwhile, of course, as winter approaches, it gets colder and colder, and the curfew's application to unhoused people would mean criminalizing and fining those who have nowhere to go at night. This is not what shelters or their users need to get through this pandemic. François Legault and Valérie Plante's inability to provide adequate support for those living unhoused in Montreal has angered many. yesterday, the Native Women's Shelter, Solidarity Across Borders, Racial Justice Collective, Meals for Milton Park, the Immigrant Workers Center, Resilience Montreal, and other groups held a press conference to denounce this imposed curfew in regards to how it will most severely affect marginalized populations. These organizations criticized the use of repressive measures, like a curfew, to fight the pandemic instead of solidarity measures to protect vulnerable communities. The press conference demanded three things. Firstly, a statement to be released by Valerie Plante to say that the SPVM police will not target, harass, or fine unhoused people unable to be inside after 8 p.m. Second, demands to open the rest of the old rural Victoria for more spaces for those living unhoused, especially for those COVID-19 positive who need to quarantine, as well as what services for those who need them. Third, a housing first system to implement permanent housing for those living unhoused in Montreal. Direct communication with those living unhoused to aid them as they want to be supported. A petition to demand the SPVM does not ticket, fine, or harass those living unhoused post the implementation of Quebec's new 8 p.m. curfew has been created. Also, a template to email your neighborhood representative in Montreal will be available in our resource list as well.
As we conclude our headlines, it is time for a rapid-fire summary of COVID-related updates. As reported by Montreal Gazette, the province's hospitals are swamped. As of Monday, Quebec reports 1,869 new cases, 51 deaths as hospitalizations surge. Legault will be reopening Quebec schools, which he describes as a quote-unquote calculated risk. Premier Legault went on to thank police officers who have handed out 740 tickets in just one weekend since the curfew has been enacted. He wants less warnings and more fines. As Maya mentioned, the new curfew is a more serious measure for the rising cases in Quebec. In regards to the vaccine, Legault reports that, quote, almost half of residents of CHSLDs, long-term care homes, have gotten a shot against COVID-19, unquote. Health Minister Christian Dubé stated that 250,000 will be vaccinated in Quebec by February 8th. According to the Montreal Gazette, quote, hospitalizations of COVID-19 patients have almost doubled in Quebec since December. It's affecting semi-urgent and non-urgent surgeries, colonoscopies, as well as consultations with family doctors, unquote. Lastly, on a lighter note, so you can walk your dog after the 8 p.m. curfew. However, one couple attempted to push those expectations. Yesterday, the Sherbrooke police saw a couple around 9 p.m. walking a man on a leash. Police spokesperson Isabel Gendron released a statement saying that the couple was fined $15,000 each and that they were not very collaborative with the police. The woman, a part of the couple, argued that the man on the leash was in fact her dog. According to Gendron, the couple said it would be a pleasure to receive a fine. Furthermore, on Saturday evening, Sherbrooke police issued 35 tickets to an anti-curfew demonstration. These fines can range from $1,000 to $6,000. That was our weekly headline roundup, which covered a lot. Our takeaways would be that we are currently in the predicted second wave, so stay distance as to not overwhelm our hospitals. Additionally, the police force has now taken to kink-shaming citizens. Well, that concludes our weekly headline roundup, so please stay tuned for a couple of songs and then our segment.
searching for a heart of gold, and I'm getting old. Keeps me searching for a heart of gold, and I'm getting old. Keep me searching for a heart.
Won't you throw me a farewell?
Now it's time for our audio essay. As mentioned earlier, we will be exploring the intersection between racism and ableism, and we're going to be focusing on autism and police brutality and how our institutions inform us incorrectly about disability. And these institutions include spaces of learning, the broader concept of language, and law enforcement. Once again, we want to issue a content warning as this segment discusses police brutality, murder, anti-Black racism, white supremacy, and ableism. But without further ado, here it is. Enjoy.
Before we begin our segment today, once again, we want to issue a content warning. This segment discusses police brutality, murder, anti-Black racism, white supremacy, and ableism. Police brutality is a symptom of white supremacy and is one of the institutions that perpetuates and maintains its oppressive structural systems of power. This summer, a series of worldwide protests took place after the killing of George Floyd at the hands of the police. The protests and subsequent media activism forced the masses to thoroughly re-examine the role of the police alongside one's own complicity in the continuation of systemic racism. At the start of the first semester, Unfit to Print released a segment that provided an overview of events of the summer related to police brutality and protests, as well as educational resources and mutual aid resources. Unfortunately, as the year of 2020 continued, media attention for community initiatives, protesting, and ways to support Black individuals and charities has dwindled. Still, there are many activists and community organizers that continue to discuss, demand, and provide informative commentary, financial resources, and awareness raising. With the new year started, UNFIT wanted to ensure that there is a continual priority of police brutality, BLM, and pro-abolition related discussions. A part of that discussion includes analyzing the nuances and intersectionality concerned with police brutality. Today, we aim to explore the role ableism plays in police enforcement, along with institutional practices that incorrectly inform society about disability. Disability is a diverse category of experience with an emphasis on individualism. So for today's episode, we'll be discussing autism, followed by a broader analysis of ableism. In September of 2020, Lyndon Cameron, a 13-year-old boy on the autism spectrum, was shot by Salt Lake City police after his mother called 911 out of concern for her son, who was experiencing a mental health crisis. Lyndon's mother requested intervention transport to take Lyndon to the hospital. Unfortunately, the police considered Lyndon potentially violent, claiming he threatened them, even though it was reported that Lyndon had no weapon on him. Lyndon's mother had called the cops because Lyndon was experiencing separation anxiety and she was not yet home. When the police arrived, Lyndon attempted to run away from his home and he was shot by the police 11 times. Lyndon suffered severe damage to his internal organs and ankle. His family is filing a lawsuit against the Salt Lake City Police. Earlier in the summer, at the end of May, only 5 days after the murder of George Floyd, Ayad Halak, a 32-year-old Palestinian man with autism, died at the hands of state authorities in Jerusalem's Old City. Ayad was not suspected of any crime. He was on the severe end of the autism spectrum, meaning his communication skills were limited. He was walking with his caretaker to the Special Needs Rehabilitation Center, where he was learning to work in a kitchen, when two security officers accused Ayad of having a gun. Confused, Ayad hid behind a garbage bin, and he was shot twice by the officers. A year prior, in August of 2019, Elijah McLean, a 23-year-old Black man, was stopped by the police for suspicious behavior as he was returning home from a trip to the convenience store to buy iced tea for his brother. Elijah was wearing a ski mask as he had anemia. When stopped, Elijah was accused of reaching for a gun, which he did not have. He was then restrained by the Colorado police in a chokehold and later sedated by paramedics, which resulted in cardiac arrest. Elijah McLean died on August 30th, 2019. Although Elijah was never diagnosed, many believed he was on the spectrum as he reflected many signs of autism. These are just three names and three lives of many that were victim to ableism and police brutality.
Dr. Tasha Oswald, founder and director of Open Doors Therapy, specializes in developmental and clinical psychology and cognitive neuroscience. On her blog, she outlines neurodivergent behaviors and sensitivities in relation to neurotypical procedures in common places. When police approach their quote-unquote suspect, one will usually encounter sirens, flashing lights, and raised voices or even megaphones. This list of possibilities, especially when combined, overwhelms the sensory system for people with autism, according to Dr. Oswald. Another concern of the doctor highlights the ability to advocate for oneself. She explains how some of her clients carry a card that describes their autism. This card is meant to be shown to a first responder or police officer in stressful situations in case one becomes nonverbal. However, if the act of reaching for one's card is misinterpreted as reaching for a weapon, an officer may act with impulse and use their own gun to injure and/or kill the suspect in question. Furthermore, Dr. Oswald describes the reality of non-visible disability in relation to police brutality. To quote Dr. Oswald, the police force has a general lack of understanding of neurodivergent. So, when interacting with a neurodivergent person, a police officer will likely expect them to behave as a neurotypical would, unquote. An example Dr. Oswald includes is difficulty making eye contact with police officers and the interpretation that the lack of eye contact is a sign of defiant behavior. Additionally, she discusses broader possibilities regarding social cues, such as sarcasm. If a police officer is attempting to be sarcastic or relies on gestures as means of communication, the neurodiverse person in question may not be able to infer the meaning of the police officer's words or actions. A 2017 report written by Aaron J. McCauley explored the likelihood of arrest by age 28 and the factors such as race and disability that increase this likelihood. The study found that 43% of her sample with a disability had been arrested by the time they reached 28. In comparison to the percentage of those without the disability was 30%. Furthermore, when race was accounted for as well as disability, the sample shows that 55% of Black youths and young adults who had a disability were being arrested, in contrast to 37% with a disability who are not Black, unquote. The persistent erasure of those with disabilities can be applied to matters of social justice. When discussing and fighting against police brutality, one must apply an intersectional understanding of the issue, and that includes learning about as well as emphasizing ableism. As stated by S.E. Smith in their article, Disability is a Hidden Side of the Police Violence Epidemic, ableism and racism are intertwined and are exacerbated by systemic inequalities such as, quote, environmental racism, occupational segregation, and poor access to healthcare, unquote.
As Dr. Oswald pointed out earlier, police misunderstand disability. When looking into police miscomprehension of disabled folks, articles and reports largely showed that resisting arrest was a component of cognitive disability that can occur when disabled folks are faced with authority figures. This resistance can be from a lack of understanding, a lack of physical control, a combination of the two. Regardless, police interpret these resists as provocation and continue to use violent measures. Police are trained to follow a command and control approach, meaning when the police address their subject, they expect and demand compliance to their orders. Of course, this approach emphasizes physical strongholds and therefore cannot be the best solution, especially in the vast majority of situations where an active shooter is not present. The ACLU reports that in the US, police academies spend an average of 58 hours on firearm training, but a mere 8 hours on de-escalation or crisis intervention. The command and control approach has a dangerous side effects, which can be seen in the police treatment of disabled folks. The high percentage of psychiatrically disabled people amongst police shootings demonstrates the dire need to improve and restructure what police training is today. Studies show that Americans with disabilities are victims of violent crimes at nearly 3 times the rate of their peers. This is an especially troubling statistic to hear when taking into account that many psychiatrically disabled individuals rely on municipal structures like the police as their first line of defense in a crisis. In order to fix this disproportionate catastrophe, activists have called for more crisis intervention team training, or CIT, for police officers. For CIT training, police officers learn patience when assessing their situation and respond calmly and appropriately instead of resorting to violence. In CIT training, police can be better equipped to understand the nature of their alleged perpetrator's intent, whether it be malicious or otherwise, and understand the functions of a disabled individual in regards to their presence. CIT training could help unpack for a police officer an individual's reasoning for resistance.
When police know, or should know, that they are interacting with a person with a disability, they have a legal obligation to proceed in ways that take into account the person's disability. Most such changes are simple, recognizing that it may take time for the person to understand what is happening, creating a calm environment, having one person communicate simply and clearly, allowing time for the person to respond to questions or instructions, and exercising patience being some of the few accommodations they can take. Such steps are called reasonable modifications under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But as with so many accommodations, implementing these practices across the board would benefit everybody, people with disabilities, the general public, and officers themselves. Furthermore, professionals suggest a greater emphasis on community policing and mental health services must be integrated into communities in order to provide disabled folks with proper accommodations. As mentioned earlier in our segment, UNFIT today aims to explore the institutional practices that inform us on disability and how these understandings are inaccurate or limited. Let us now explore these institutions, first starting with the role that language plays when discussing and educating neurotypicals on disability. For context, we will be focusing on the English language.
Lydia Brown, a disability advocate, explains how ableism is rooted in colloquial English. According to Brown, quote, "If we believe people with mental illness should not be in our workplace, life, family, or neighborhood, then it's easier to rationalize using ableist words. You might think, only crazy people do that. I don't do that, so it's okay for me to say. But when people say these things, they send a signal to people with psychosocial disabilities that we are not welcome," unquote. Although Brown, in this quote, specifically refers to mental illness, they shed a light on the greater issue experienced by those with both mental illness and neurodivergent individuals in regards to language. Our euphemisms, humorous insults, and metaphors normalize ableism to such an extent that one may not even be aware that the phrase in question is ableist. For example, phrases such as "turn a blind eye" are considered ableist, as well as words like "dumb" or "lame." Additionally, the reliance on ableism as a tool of humor further stigmatizes and dehumanizes disability, implying that disability is abnormal. This attitude towards disability perpetuates the narrative that there is a need to fix one's disability in order for them to function and fit in with societal norms.
As mentioned earlier by Dr. Oswald, police expect neurodivergents to behave in a neurotypical way. This expectation stems from the way neurotypical norms frame neurodivergent behaviors as unusual. The normalization of ableism, along with limited teachings of disability, can have dangerous results. To combat ableism, we must observe every sector of life to understand how we contribute to the stigmatization of disability. Adjusting our language is a practice we all must prioritize, and learning the biased language we incorporate in our day-to-day lives is essential for unlearning ableism as a whole. At the end of our segment, we will be linking relevant resources, including Lydia Brown's list of ableist words and sayings, so check that out to educate yourself on phrases and or words you may or may not know that are in fact ableist.
Now we want to focus on ableism in places of learning. Although so many schools advocate for multiculturalism and acceptance, disability and ableism are overlooked in this advocacy. There is a limited to non-existent priority of disability-related discussions, both mental and physical, in our school systems. In fact, we often see a hush-hush narrative in schools where administrations promote a them versus us culture, separating those who are neurodivergent into different classes and sectors than their neurotypical peers. Ableism plays an influential role in the struggle to include neurodivergent students. Through this dichotomy, negative assumptions about disabilities are created as neurotypical students see their neurodivergent peers as othered. Besides the evident separation of students with and without disabilities in schools, the infrastructure of educational institutions, well, institutions in general, often don't accommodate disabled folks. Many early discussions of ableism in higher education focuses on legal requirements for buildings, ensuring accessibility through the additions of ramps and elevators. Professor Jay Delmage from the University of Waterloo notes that this initial focus promoted a lens on disability that was purely legal and medical. Disability could be seen, due to this characterization, as a diagnosis rather than a component of one's identity. As educational institutions switch to online platform, schools see digital technology that benefits neurodivergent students as a cost rather than an investment to make.
Professor Delmage also provides an interesting statistic that around 90% of students with learning disabilities receive accommodations in high school, and only 10% of these students seek out accommodations at university. This statistic is a symptom of university culture, where admitting you need help seems out of the question, which is inherently ableist. Additionally, the very definition of productivity and efficiency is rooted in capitalism, which suggests that neurodivergent individuals are inherently less productive than neurotypicals. Re-examining and redefining our academic cultures alongside our interpretation of productivity is essential. In order to combat ableism, teachers and students without disabilities must have active engagement and education on disability culture and its effects of ableism to properly incorporate disability content into their curriculum. Furthermore, the structure of education needs to be personalized. Standardized testing and generalized grading will not accommodate the needs of every student, nor the needs of every disability. Therefore, education must be considered a universal right, and those in charge of educational institutions need to implement accessibility in every sector of student life and remove such a capitalist, high-working, and perfectionist agenda as their number one priority. Furthermore, there are so many disabled scholars and activists, as well as tons of research and work authored by disabled folks that can be incorporated into the curriculum. Additionally, literature is a vital component when it comes to informing students on disability, as well as shaping biases. If students, even at a young age, are given books that have positive portrayals of characters with disabilities, the act of othering can be changed.
As mentioned earlier in our segment, the intersection of ableism and race needs to be applied to mainstream discussions of police brutality. According to Lydia Brown, in their article, "We Can't Address Disability Without Addressing Race, Here's Why," quote, "School systems administrators are quick to make superior diagnoses of stigmatized and criminalized disabilities for students of color. They're also far less likely to accurately identify learning and developmental disabilities when actually present in the same population. Most people associate autism and ADD mainly or entirely with white boys, who in turn are seen in need of services and help. It's a stark contrast to the consistent deprivation and denial of resources, suspicion of malingering or fraud, and open criminalization to which disabled students of color are consistently subjected," unquote.
The representation and common perception of disability is often inaccurate. However, on top of that, it is also very white. Therefore, people of color must navigate their disability through a lens of white supremacy. To quote Lydia Brown again, "The histories of ableism and racism are codependent and intertwined. Those histories inform and underlie the inequities and injustices facing disabled people of color in both individual lives and in our advocacy work. The definition of disability under global white supremacy is rooted in whiteness. Both disabledness and abledness are defined based on proximity to and approximation of whiteness as an idea. What that means is that to be defined as fully non-disabled requires being white. White disabled people's disabilities detract from their whiteness, and disabled people of color's abilities accentuate our supposed inferiority and inhumanity due to race. And even people of color who are not disabled will be harmed by ableism because it is a value system about people's bodily worth, unquote. Ableism, racism, and capitalism are driving forces into upholding the colonial structures that make up society. Circling back to how social media participants slowly reverted back to their quote-unquote normal feeds, reconsider your faded interest in and passion for topics such as police brutality. If you are someone with privilege, reconsider why you've made this choice. We encourage you to continue educating yourself and amplifying Black voices.
With the 2021 year just starting, the Montreal government has announced that they will be increasing the SPVM budget by $15 million. As outlined in this segment, police do not serve and protect everyone. Although reform and training is one approach, defunding the police is the most productive solution when it comes to protecting neurodivergent individuals, along with those experiencing mental health crises. Police cannot be our first responders when it comes to crisis and those with disabilities. Time and time again, police have proven to us that they are impulsive and violent, acting on their implicit or explicit biases of marginalized folks. Defunding the police will allow for financial support of community-oriented services, as well as investments in education. This educational funding could include more school-related services for those with disabilities. Defunding the police is not a radical take. It is a necessity and a matter of safety. Well, folks, that concludes our segment for today. We hope that you found it informative. Now we're going to...
We have the activist who was mentioned multiple times throughout the segment, Lydia Brown. We're including their ableist glossary, but also just their website in general. So just a little recap, Lydia Brown is an activist who focuses on disability rights. The link above is a list of ableist phrases and words to avoid their use and replacement sayings instead. Furthermore, we also have another link from Lydia Brown, which is called We Can't Address Disability Without Addressing Race, Here's Why. And it's an article that explores the intersection between ableism and racism.
Next up, we have Professor Jay Delmage and his article slash interview with University of Waterloo and their sort of arts section. He has a book titled Academic Ableism. He discusses cultures and physical structures of ableism in higher educational institutions.
All right, so next up, we have an influencer type person for our resource list. Their YouTube is Autistic Tyla. We have the link, and basically just a little excerpt from her bio is, "Hello, I'm Tyla, diagnosed autistic age 17. I'm now in my early 20s and navigating adulthood. I've always been fascinated by lifestyle design, which is about living life with intention. I care about lifestyle design because I am autistic and the things that seem to work for everyone else aren't quite right for me." So every week she posts YouTube videos exploring topics about her autistic lifestyle. And it's a cool influencer channel. Check it out.
Next up, we have Sue Ambrowski. With their article, Why Many Autistic People Prefer Identity First Language. So the title is kind of self-explanatory about what it's about, but I'll read a quick excerpt just because I think it's a really interesting article. Quote, "It's not like we're being defined by this horrible thing that needs to be separated from us. Autism, or any other disability for that matter, is not something one carries with them like an accessory, but rather part of what makes up who they are. To separate autism from someone would be to make them a totally different person. It's an operating system." Unquote.
Next up, we just have a link to a fund to support undocumented people in Montreal. This is a rapid response fund that assists undocumented people who cannot access government services and are possibly facing homelessness.
So next we have a petition, which was mentioned in our headlines, titled Amnesty for Individuals Living Unhoused from Quebec's Curfew Fines. So as we know, Quebec has just announced their 8 p.m. curfew as a response to the pandemic. However, homeless people and unhoused people are being included in this fine, which is, to me, ridiculous. But I'm going to read the description in the petition. Quote, Meals for Milton Park is demanding the City of Montreal and the Province of Quebec to give pardon to those living unhoused from the possible fines of Quebec's new 8 p.m. curfew going into place on Saturday, January 9th, 2021. We are concerned about the health and well-being of the unhoused population of the City of Montreal, which has doubled since the onset of the pandemic. Shelters have had to close due to outbreaks of COVID-19, and those that remain open must serve fewer people in order to keep socially distant while lacking the financing to meet demand. Meanwhile, it gets colder and colder, and the curfew's application to unhoused people would mean criminalizing and fining those who have nowhere to go at night. This is not what shelters or their users need to get through this pandemic, and it's time to act for the most vulnerable of our neighbors.
So last but not least, we have the Saint-Paul restaurants Roulant, which provides meals on wheels for those dealing with the economic hardships exacerbated by the pandemic. So those in Montreal obviously know Saint-Paul, the restaurant, or not obviously, but it's quite the local staple. And this link provides links for monetary contributions, clothes, goods, and volunteer positions to help those out.
All right, folks, that's all we have for today. So up next, we have a few more songs and then our sign-off. Enjoy.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. We hope you found our audio essay interesting and informative. Up next, we're playing Peach Love with Cereal. So stay tuned. Wake up and smell coffee and bagels.
I'll send you off. Wave goodbye and peek my head through the door. Hello for no reason. A familiar scent drifts through the air. I remember the sweet bowl of cereal. Thank you.
was Peach Left with Cereal. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT.
Of angel hair and ice cream castles in the air and feather canyons everywhere. But now they only block the sun.
All Quebecers, we must take extreme measures to curb the pandemic. Only essential services remain open. Gatherings are prohibited. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. These efforts aim to protect our healthcare workers, seniors, and loved ones. Let's comply with the lockdown and curfew to lower the risk of contracting COVID-19, because our health is important. For more information, visit quebec.ca/confinement. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to Urban Indigenous Radio. On tonight's show, we're playing the first hour of the latest episode of the Red Nation podcast entitled Settlers Gone Wild, Capitol Hill Edition. To listen to the rest of the episode, head over to theRedNation.org. As a content warning, this episode contains coarse language.
Let's go.
All right, so this is Power Hour in the brand new year of 2021.
It is not the new year. It's December 38th.
Yeah, it's December 38th.
This is Red Power. I don't know. We're keeping all of this. We are keeping all of this. All right.
All This is the Red Nation podcast with your host, Nick Estes. And we have some amazing news to announce for the year 2021. Red Nation podcast has been, you know, variously co-hosted or guest hosted by Red Nation comrades. But this year, we're actually inviting our comrade Jen Marley on to the show as a permanent co-host.
Woohoo!
So Yay! She's joining us today in this run on the Q Shaman, and it's all dedicated to the Q Shaman.
Q Savage.
Yeah, Q Savage.
Q Savage.
Q the Savage, the Dior Savage commercial.
Lawrence of QAnonia.
Yeah, QAnonia.
Lawrence of QAnonia. Oh, shit.
Dances with Qs. All right. Jen Marley, who are you? Where do you come from?
Why are you here?
And why are you here?
Show us your papers.
Yeah, show us your papers. Storm in the podcast, like.
Wait, did you introduce me?
Oh, yeah. Cena's on here, too.
God, rude.
Why is this guy here?
Who the fuck is me? Okay, I'll tell you.
Yeah, wait your turn.